Welcome to Turning Pages, a series of in-depth conversations with authors about their works.
All right. Well, his latest novel's On the Ravine, Dr. Vincent Lam joins me to discuss it. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Now, I have lots of questions about the book, but I guess the first one I want to ask is returning to a character you'd previously written. Did you consider telling this story with someone else, or was it just naturally like that Dr. Chen was going to be kind of your through line in terms of telling this story now?
Well, I have to tell you, Michael, I am possibly the most inefficient writer in the entire world, certainly amongst writers whom I know, in that I tend to write things lots of different ways and I use different characters, and then it kind of coalesces such that I realize who the character is, I realize what's going on in the story. And so different parts, different versions, different conceptions of this were written with and without Dr. Chen, with and without Dr. Fitzgerald. And somehow this is where it landed. Somehow it kind of pulled together. And it felt like these characters had, in a sense, evolved from some of the characters who were in Bloodletting and Miraculous Cures. And when I realized that, it felt right to have the characters continue from one book to the next.
So there is a version of this where you wrote the physicians as like completely different physicians?
Yes, yes, yeah. There's versions in which there's more physicians, more characters, different physicians. Believe me, there's so many. I have the multiverse version of writing.
The everything everywhere all at once, everything one where the physician has hot dog hands and...
I didn't do a hot dog hands version. I didn't have anyone eating lipstick.
No.
But everything short of that.
Everything short of that. So does that then come out with your editor to kind of like hone down that this should be who these people are, like which characters they are? Or is that yourself in your own drafts? Like, how do you kind of suss that out?
Well, I have a wonderful relationship with my editor, Martha Kenya Forstner at Penguin Random House Knopf. And she takes a view, I think, that her role is more the question-asking piece. So often Martha will read something and she'll raise really, really great questions, blind spots, and things that don't quite fit together, that don't quite work. Even though sometimes I would dearly wish that someone would just give me the answer, she doesn't do that, and I have to go away and come up with the answer. And it's usually in answering those questions in that dialogue between writer and editor that I manage to suss out what it is in my drafting multiverse that actually makes sense. And sometimes out of that dialogue, new things arise as well. So there was at least one character who only came into existence quite late in the novel, really as a response to editorial questions. And so for me, that's really exciting to kind of have that emerge from the dialogue, emerge from the conversation, and find its way into the book.
I noticed in the acknowledgments you said you're thankful to Martha for the questions she asked of the novel's characters. Is she asking you kind of like motivational questions or like their actions, or what kind of probing questions does she ask? Like you said, she doesn't provide the answers, but she at least kind of in asking a question points you somewhere.
Yeah. A lot of those questions are, why is the character doing this? Does it make sense that the character is doing this? And it's also where there are things that maybe as a writer, I just kind of assume that, oh, well, I understand the character. So it kind of seems obvious to me that this is what the character would do. But sometimes there can be a big blind spot. I may not realize that I haven't actually made it clear to the reader why the character would do that. Maybe I haven't given enough information. Maybe I haven't fleshed out a sequence in action sufficiently. And those are some of the things where it's really wonderful to have an attentive editor, someone who's really interested in story and who's also really interested in human nature, because ultimately it should be human nature that is driving what's on the page.
Is there ever any question of like a person you've written and someone saying like they wouldn't do that? Like that someone doesn't ring true to the character you've established of them, but for like plot motivations, maybe you've had them do something? Is that an aspect of this?
Yeah, I think it's always possible. And you know, certainly in terms of my sense of who the characters are in On the Ravine, I feel quite comfortable that the characters whom I know in On the Ravine are doing what those characters would do. And of course, they're fictional. And so that gives me both a lot of responsibility in terms of creating them, but a lot of freedom in terms of imagining who they are and what they do. And I certainly accept that it may be that a reader comes and says, gosh, if I were in that situation, I wouldn't necessarily do that. And I can completely understand that. And there's a couple of things that are really interesting and fruitful, I think, in the reading experience that comes out of that. I think, you know, if we read something and we think, gee, I wouldn't necessarily do that, then that allows us to explore, oh, okay, so how is it that I'm different than the characters such that I wouldn't necessarily be doing this? And maybe that helps me to understand myself in a bit of a different way. And it also allows me to think, wow, so this character, they seem to be operating in a way that's foreign to my intuition. What does that mean about who they are and what their life consists of? And so for me, that's actually a really exciting part of the reading experience. I hope that that readers are actually able to experience that from time to time.
Is that what you look for as a reader, like something that challenges you? I mean, to come up against what you yourself might inhabit and then think about why a character is doing something oppositional to that or outside of, you know, your own instinct or perspective?
Yes, for sure. When I'm reading, and I think it's more intuitive, I don't sort of sit here as if I'm at a microphone thinking, oh, well, you know, this character, blah-de-blah-de-blah. But I think at a level of engagement, that's often what's happening. Part of the pleasure of reading is imagining the lives of others. And we can only do so, in a sense, through imagining ourselves in those lives. And yet there is the pleasure of that being an imagined life which is not our own. And that's probably a more elegant and succinct way of saying all that blah-de-blah-de stuff that I said, you know, 30 mm-hmm. seconds.
In On the Ravine, you give the reader essentially like two different people's lives and like they're not necessarily our avatars, but there are throughways through the story of the book. Was that important to have kind of not just like Dr. Chen's perspective on Claire as a patient or Claire with her perspective of Dr. Chen as a physician? Did you always imagine having, I don't want to say parallel because they're not necessarily parallel, but like conflictual viewpoints, let's say?
Well, there were always lots of different people who were impacting Claire's life. And at different stages of the writing, those were different people. You know, I'm trying to remember, was there a version? There was probably a version at some point where it was different doctors. I don't think that there was a version where it was just one doctor. It's funny, all these things become sort of convoluted when I think about my own twisted pathways of working through the novel. But, you know, for sure, there were always lots of people. And I think that's part of what allows us to animate characters through action, right? We have people interacting with other characters in order to be able to understand what they're going to do. And that certainly was always the case in terms of Claire. She was always torn between different people who were wanting different things of her, for her. And in the midst of that, she was trying to find her own path. And that's very much how we all live our lives. You know, we have our idea and we're also pulled this way and pulled that way by the people in our lives.
So Dr. Chen runs the Swan Clinic. He treats people who use drugs and Claire comes to him. You yourself, you know, as a physician, work in the field of working with people who use drugs. When you're writing like this, how much are you trying to dramatize things that you see on a day-to-day basis versus, you know, like fictionalizing it in like in a grandized way, or like in such a way that it like no one patient can be like, this is me. What kind of tightrope walk do you have to do in terms of fictionalizing or creating this, the world of On the Ravine, out of your own world?
Sure, that's a great question. And this is certainly a world that I know intimately. And it's really knowing that world intimately which allows me to fictionalize. And so it gives me a jumping off point. It gives me a set of parameters, a set of forces, which I'm familiar with. And being familiar with that set of parameters and forces, I'm able to fictionalize. So for me, it's actually incredibly important that there is a significant distance between what happens in my day-to-day actual life as a doctor and what happens in the fictional lives of my characters who are imaginary doctors. And it's actually quite important that there is a clear distance, both for me as a writer as well as on the page. First of all, because doctor-patient confidentiality is extremely important, and I take that very seriously and would never wish to violate that very important trust. But also as a writer, it's really important that I have the freedom to be able to explore something which is not what happened, to explore something which is different than what I encounter, because that's really the only way of actually inhabiting the fictional world. And so it ends up meaning there's some explicit choices, for instance. So I have patients in my real life work as a real life doctor who are involved in all kinds of different work in all different segments of society. And I have no patients who are violinists and no patients who would fit the description of Claire. And so that's really important to me as a starting point. I also think it's really interesting to think about music and think about art because it's a way of thinking about beauty. And beauty is something which I think we're all aiming towards in one way or another in our lives. So if I want to think about beauty, this really important force that pervades all of our lives, I think, and all of our desires and motivations, I can really only explore that in fiction if I'm free of what's going on in my actual everyday life. So that does end up forming certain choices. For instance, Claire being a violinist, if I was to have considered Claire engaged in some sort of, say, artistic pursuit that by coincidence one of my patients was already engaged in, then I would have discarded that because it wouldn't have given me enough freedom, and it also would have risked the violation of the sense of confidentiality. I mean, even if I were to, you know, I guess I'm writing about Toronto and Toronto actually exists, but I don't think that people's sense of confidentiality is violated by the fact that I'm writing about a city of 4 million people.
Right. Her being an artist, was that integral in terms of tapping into something about kind of creativity and the tension that she has in terms of when she's thinking too much, she's unsure of herself, and when she's kind of not thinking, her muse flies and she's only tapping into that through using?
Yeah, that's a really good observation. And it is integral that Claire is an artist. And there certainly is that performative aspect of things, that sense, I think, which we have in all arts, whether they are performative arts, meaning predominantly arts on the stage, or whether they're more, I'm not sure what the word is, but, you know, art where you do it in a sense removed from the actual experience of the art, such as writing, meaning I sit here in my little room and I write, and that's not the same moment that someone necessarily reads the book. So I think in both those disciplines, there is always this sense that I have to let go of myself in some way in order to do the best work. And so you're absolutely right. That's absolutely part of the force that I imagined for this character. And then the other thing, which is really important to me, is that I think in art, there's always desire. There's always this sense of wanting to achieve something, wanting to get somewhere, wanting to have something beautiful come out of what I'm doing. And yet there's very often also a great deal of uncertainty. There's a great deal of apprehension about whether or not the thing I'm doing is actually beautiful. Is it actually true? Is it actually resonant in some way? And the tension between the desire to do that, the desire to do something which is beautiful and resonant, and the fulfillment of that hope really fills the life of artists. And I think in some ways it fills also all of our lives, whether we think of ourselves as artists or not, but it's crystallized in a very direct way in the work of an artist. And so to me, it was really important that this central character in On the Ravine, Claire, be an artist, be someone who cares about beauty and about her most beautiful possible art.
Dr. Chen's work, as I mentioned, you know, he treats patients at this clinic, but that's only part of what he does. He also works with a company that designs studies for new drugs. And it seems to me he's most at ease when he's in control of a process as far as a study, or at least kind of like just like locked in at that point. I was curious about kind of creating that for him, that like, obviously, ultimately, the end goal is, you know, for the good of the patient, but he seems to be kind of most animated when it comes to designing a study and looking at process and kind of being almost one step removed from the patient. And then that does create like a later conflict when that comes up against a concern for a patient. Was that right there from the beginning in terms of thinking about Chen and how he would function in this story?
Yes, I think that force was always there. And that is really kind of integral to Chen's nature. Chen is also oriented towards trying to do the best possible thing and ultimately the most beautiful thing in the work that he tries to do. And woven into that is his real conviction that rationality, that a sense of judicious skepticism, methodical process is the way that he can deliver the best thing for his patients. And meanwhile, Chen is also a human being. So in his day-to-day work, he's always thinking, okay, well, you know, in this particular situation, what if I just try a little bit harder? What if I just try a little bit more? What if I kind of take an extra step? Will that make the difference for this patient? And he's also someone who is very much haunted by a loss, and a loss which comes out of his very human qualities of having desired someone and of having lost them and having to address them only through memory and only through a sense of what could have been and what might have been. And so Chen is very much on this tightrope between these instincts which pull him towards a direct human connection. And of course, direct human connection can never be based in studies and data in the same way that, say, a medical protocol could be or should be. And he's really walking a tightrope between that and his conviction that his work is at its best when it's driven by careful and insightful process and methodological investigation.
That it allows him to kind of put his blinders on in some way to just focus on data and process and divorce it from the patient or the person. The conceit of the letters.
I want to push back on that. Jump in and disagree. I don't think it actually allows him to put his blinders on. If his blinders were on, he would be an awfully dull character in this novel.
I'm just thinking of like the points at which he's designing the study. He seems to be locked into the process of the study to the point of like frustration from those at the, you know, the board level and things, that how he designs a study is very rigorous. and they're trying to kind of push, I mean, obviously for different motivations, but that, you know, they, but obviously you're the author. So you see Chen as a different thing. I just thought like he's kind of in his truest sense, or at least he's not wrestling with things.
Yeah. But, and, you know, this is that great process, of course, as we were discussing earlier, of people reading and thinking, but wait a minute, even though the author is saying this, I'm not really sure that's what, and I mean, that is part of the wonderful thing about reading.
Mm-hmm.
And in those moments, which I think you're absolutely correct in describing, what I'm imagining for Chen is that he is also inhabiting that tension at that moment, that he is still just one character. So we can imagine his two sides, his passionate side and his rational side. But he's stuck just being Chen.
Yes, no, for sure. In terms of looking at the treatment of people who use drugs, I know that you'd written a recent Globe and Mail piece and that you wrestle with kind of what best way to do it. And Chen certainly wrestles with that. Did you have any ambivalence about kind of working through that on in a fictional page at the same time as working through that as a real practicing doctor? Like, did you allow yourself the freedom to just do whatever you wanted with Chen that seemed truest to him? Or did you feel like you had to kind of tackle some of these questions you yourself have and process wise within that character? Like, I don't want to say serve as an avatar, but at least kind of like a sounding board for you.
Yeah. Well, Chen is certainly not an avatar. Chen is a fictional character in a novel. I do think that one of the really, really important things that novels do, whether it's a novel like On the Ravine, which is rooted in the forces of the opioid crisis, or any other novel, is that it allows us to understand human dynamics in a different way. And that allows us often to understand a really difficult and complex situation in a different way. And there's no doubt that the opioid crisis is a very, very important issue which we're confronting in North America and which we're grappling with in terms of trying to figure out the best possible ways to address it. And I grapple with that as a professional in this field. However, for me, I think that the contribution that fiction makes is different in an important way, because it allows us to understand what certain concepts, which are, say, medical and physiological, actually are in terms of how they impact people. So, for instance, take the issue of opioid withdrawal. I can tell someone that if a person is dependent on opioids and they suddenly don't have opioids within their body, that they will experience a truly terrible physical syndrome known as opioid withdrawal. And I can go through and describe all of those symptoms and talk about how terrible it is. And it is terrible. That's one way of describing it. And that's a legitimate way of describing it. Another legitimate way of describing it is when we use that in fiction. And now we're not talking about a real person experiencing that, because we're talking about a fictional character, but we are talking about something that actually happens in the world. Just like when we're writing about Toronto, Toronto has become fictionalized, but we are writing about a place which exists. So for me, it's actually really, really important to be relatively agenda-free when I'm writing, because I don't think that the contribution of fiction is necessarily to give the answers to all the questions that people might have in terms of prescriptive policy, in terms of, you know, quote, stances on things, although I kind of, you know, worry in the real world that people taking, quote, stances on things can actually be counterproductive. But I certainly don't think that that's the role of fiction. I think the role of fiction is hopefully to leave people with deeper questions, more nuanced questions, more informed questions, and if anything, a greater sense of uncertainty about some of the things they may have previously thought. And so the only way I can really achieve that as a novelist is to set aside any sort of murmurings of agenda, any murmurings of, what I may happen to speculate is the right thing to do, because there's a lot of unknown in this field of medicine, as there are in many fields of medicine, and to really write from the characters. Because writing from the characters, I think, is the best possible way for me to help people to underpin their understanding of this important issue through fictional characters.
You mentioned A Real Toronto. The ravine that Dr. Chen goes on a bike ride with Fitzgerald with, is there an actual point at which there was like construction refuse that's been grassed over and become like a point along that cycling ride?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's a well-known park in Toronto, Tommy Thompson Park. And once upon a time, the Toronto Islands were connected to Toronto, and so they weren't an island at all, but it was a point of land which was connected by way of this long sort of finger that swept out from the shore. And Toronto Islands became an island at some point. I don't have the year at my fingertips. In the course of a violent storm, which rendered them into islands. And ever since then, there's been an effort to rebuild some of that pre-existing jut of land and extend it. And that's been done largely through the deposition of construction waste, and then also used to form a nature preserve. So it's been constructed to be a bird habitat, as well as a recreational space. So yeah, anyone who wants to go and either walk or ride their bicycle on Tommy Thompson Park can definitely do so. It's really there.
I just found it interesting that it was a place of both refuse and refuge, and that, you know, that's the titular place that they are is on that ravine. So I just found it interesting and was wondering whether that was a fictional conceit or a real thing.
I was referring actually a moment ago to a spit of land, which has two names. Mm. It's both called the Tommy Thompson Park and the Leslie Street Spit. So it's really like this finger of land which comes out from the shore. That's what I was talking about a moment ago. But the ravines,
I guess they start on the ravine bike ride and end up on that spit is maybe what I'm thinking.
Right.
Trying to think of like the geography of their travels.
Yes, those places actually did connect, and they will in the future, but right now there's a massive construction site between as there is everywhere in Toronto, but the ravines on the ravine are definitely a major feature in Toronto. So I think anyone who lives in Toronto will know that some of the most magical accessible green space in Toronto is in the ravine, and hence this novel is on the ravine.
Well, the book is On the Ravine. It's out now through Penguin Random House. Dr. Vincent Lam, thanks very much for taking some time to talk about the book.
Really great to be here.